It's the Burt Cohen Show. History is now. The past isn't even past. It's been 100 years since the breakout of the First World War, which, of course, was not called the First World War at the time. It was just called the Great War because it was so big and so incredibly costly in terms of human lives that it became finally World War I, followed up by a Second World War, of course. And at this 100-year anniversary, it's good to look at what the war really was and how it happened and to see if there might be anything we can learn from. Well, I'm very pleased that our guest today is Gordon Adams, professor of international relations at American University's School of International Service. Thanks very much for being with us, Dr. Adams.
Happy to be with you, Bert.
Well, he also teaches national security policy and resource planning. He's a distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center. Stimson, I believe, worked for Franklin Roosevelt, where he directs the program on budgeting for foreign affairs and defense. He's published widely on defense and national security policy, the defense policy process, and national security budgets. Well, again, thanks for being with us, Dr. Adams. Your new article in the current Foreign Policy magazine, the title is Echoes of 1914? A Strange, Dangerous, and Oddly Familiar Era of Declining American Power, Global Rebalancing, and Profound Inequality is Upon Us. Of course, there are, you know, never any exact parallels in history. But the Great War marked a huge change in the alignment of international powers that were. If you would, please, Dr. Adams, tell us, please, about who the great powers were before the outbreak of that horrible war 100 years ago.
It's almost unimaginable who some of them were because they disappeared altogether after the First World War. What's really interesting about this period is before the First World War, you had dominant countries and empires like the Russian Empire, the German Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire,
right,
the British Empire, the French Empire, and the Japanese attempt to begin to expand in the Pacific. All of these massive players before the First World War begin to jostle with each other. And what was really happening underneath that jostling was a formidable rebalancing of the international system. A system where the Brits had been very much in the lead was beginning to be jostled not only by the rise of the United States as a power, but by all of these changes and the internal upheavals that were happening in the monarchies of Europe, the German monarchy, the Russian monarchy, the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. I think that while history does not repeat itself, as Mark Twain once said, it kind of rhymes. And what we are seeing today is a rather formidable rebalancing of the international system where we don't quite know where the outcome is going to go.
Right.
We see a rising China. We see a Brazil in the South American continent. We see India rising in the Indian Ocean area. We see Iran playing a regional role. We see the Russians reasserting themselves. We see the Europeans kind of backing off in a way, only the French really doing any extensive global operations.
True.
Even the Brits have pulled back. And what we see relative to all those other countries is the United States, which we touted 10, 15 years ago as the hyperpower that had succeeded out of the Cold War, is facing a rebalancing of the system. It's not a decline. It's not really that the U.S. has any less power than it once had. It's about relative power.
Right.
It's about relative impact in the system. And what I think is interestingly familiar to the pre-World War I period is a lot of uncertainty about where the system is going to go. Mm. We don't know what's going to happen in Asian theater. We don't know how the Indians will assert themselves. We don't know whether the Russian recovery under Putin is going to be short-term or long-term. There's a lot of question marks now in the international system, and the very balance in the international system. That was an enormously destabilizing reality before the First World War. It led to a conflict that nobody wanted and everybody was praying for at the same time. It was triggered by a little flashpoint in the Balkans,
right,
which was the friction front, if you will, between
right.
The Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Russian Empire over Serbia, by a terrorist attack on a leader. And while the terrorist problems today are not the same as those terrorist problems, they are terrorist problems, and they're terrorist problems in a tinderbox area, much as the Balkans was on a global basis today. We have the Middle East as a tinderbox, as an area of profound upheaval and change. No power, not even the United States, and certainly nobody else, can tell you how things are going to evolve in the Middle East. But we have a combustive mix there of civil war, of the overthrow of authoritarian dictators, of fights over boundaries, of an intrusion by a regional power, Iran, a face-off between the Iranians and the Saudis across the Gulf, and a lot of things that the Americans don't control, nobody controls.
Right.
We don't quite know where they're going. And then you have Iran potentially seeking a nuclear weapon. If they do, a trigger to Turkey, to Egypt, to other countries in the region, you have an existing Israeli nuclear capability in the region. So we've got this massive tinderbox in the Middle East, oddly rhyming, if you will, with the tinderbox that was in the Balkans, where empires were at the edges of friction. So just in terms of the system itself and the evolution and the unpredictability, there's this eerie resemblance.
Yeah, it is. Rhymes are nice in songs, but not in this case. And a lot of people were really appalled, the people on the left and the right, when President Obama was seemingly about to bomb Syria. It reminded many of us a lot of, frankly, Serbia and the Balkan instability in, the 19-teens, just over 100 years ago, with, here in Serbia you have Russia and Iran on one side, the Saudis and many others on the opposing side. And, you talk about a tinderbox. It's already a huge, horrible war. Now, Obama is no longer talking about bombing Syria. The danger seems to have passed. But then again, there are the peace talks, which certainly could break down and be another spark. Am I stretching things here?
I don't think you're stretching things. And the key feature of this is the unknowability of the outcome. Just in the Syrian situation alone, as you point out, Bert, you've got you've got ethnic friction. You've got religious friction. If you think about why Balkans was a tinderbox, at the core of this was not just political rights against the Austro-Hungarian Empire. At the core of this was what became Yugoslavia.
Right.
You have the ethnic religious friction between Roman Catholicism, Orthodox Christianity, and Islam.
Yes.
That's at the core of the crisis in the 1990s in this region. In the Middle East, you have Shiite, Sunni, overlapping with political jurisdictions, arguing about the role of religion in politics. So you've got a bunch of ethnic conflicts that seem very, very hard to stop. And you've got great powers playing at the edges of this. Saudi, Sunni, Iran, Shia, Russians, influence in Syria, Americans, Israel, You've got outside countries playing in this tinderbox of tension, any one of whom could be destabilizing the whole situation by a military action. And what Obama was proposing to do, and what upset some of our allies, the Saudis are now very upset with the United States, very upset, because the United States did not bomb the Syrian government, mm-hmm. did not bomb the chemical weapons sites. And the Saudis are saying, you're now an unreliable ally. We will have to take on some of this responsibility for supporting the surge against Assad by ourselves because we can't count on you. That reaction of we can't count on you, to me, is a real trigger about the rebalancing of the system. Because over the past 10 years, we've seen countries basically say, we have to go on our own. And it's not because the United States is weak. It's because other countries are rising. The Indians, unhappy with how their diplomat was handled in New York, have been fractious in throwing U.S. diplomats out. The Turks prevented the United States from invading Iraq from the north by not allowing Turkey to be used as the base, as the ground for such an invasion from the north. The Egyptians are now fractious because Mubarak is gone. And the relationship between the U.S. and al-Sisi in Cairo is nothing like the relationship that previously existed with Mubarak. The Saudis are unhappy in this region with the United States and its policies and politics. You have this rebalancing, this retooling of the international system, where it's no longer possible to have what existed at the beginning of the Cold War, which was basically in the so-called Western camp, when the United States said frog, everybody else jumped. The system's not responding that way anymore.
And I'm also reminded, I hadn't heard about the frog, but there was that old expression during the Cold War, mutually assured destruction, or MAD, that it frankly does remind me of the situation prior to the Great War, that each of the sides, you know, the Germans, the British, everybody was building up weapons systems and delivery systems like crazy, figuring, well, they won't mess with us. We're too well armed. And, you know, I suppose it, I mean, the U.S. and the Soviet Union did not go to war. I don't know how much it had to do with the, you know, the huge weapons on either side. But as you're talking about, Professor Adams, that weapon systems and military might alone, they can still be, as you say, rebalanced.
We have it's absolutely right. We have a sense that with an adequate supply of military capability, we can essentially exercise a pressure on the system so that things will change. But there are, won't change in any direction we don't want. But what's really interesting about this period, and again, mirroring, if you will, or rhyming with the period before the First World War, is just in the area of weapons technology itself. We are entering a new era in terms of weapons technology. We are looking at biological weapons capabilities. We're looking at nanotechnologies, which have all kinds of military applications. We're looking at unmanned aerial vehicles unmanned ground vehicles. The possibilities of doing things with military capability that are unimagined, if you will. And some of these things, unmanned aerial vehicles, for example, are not that expensive. So we combine with a huge evolution in military technology and general technology with military applications with a reduction in the cost of actually availing yourself of those technologies, which puts, at the moment, it's not clear where the relationship is between the offense and the defense here in military terms. There's an advantage to asymmetrical cheap investment on the part of countries or non-countries like terrorist organizations who may be able to lay their hands on technology that can be a pinprick in the overall order of things. A nuclear war would have been much more than a pinprick, but can be, you know, annoying and destabilizing in particular countries and then set loose other forces to which big powers respond. So military technology itself is another aspect of this rhyming with the Edwardian pre-World War I era.
It's frightening, it's eerie, and just to hear, you know, you, Professor Gordon Adams, talk about the Edwardian period, you know, the image that that phrase alone conjures up is, you know, the British royalty completely out of touch with any sense of the dramatic change that was just ahead. And, you know, you think about, I mean, one of the things that always seems to be the case, perhaps I'm wrong again, is the issue of class, quite frankly. If, you know, the few powerful against the many without power, without money. And my understanding of formerly Great Britain, England, joining the war, before they joined the war, you know, they were clear on, you know, what was right and what was wrong. And there was this royal class that was absolutely in control. The British Empire throughout the world worked all for their benefit. If this sounds a little bit like Downton Abbey, well, it is. And, you know, just before the war, you talk about class struggles. My understanding that there was a dangerous instability with regard to Ireland, which I think there was a lot of class war aspect of it. And the war on the continent certainly was convenient for the ruling class. They, you know, any sense of Irish nationalism, the whole Catholic Protestant thing, which was, again, as you mentioned, I mean, religious wars, yikes. Today, there's a nearly incomprehensible gap between the few super rich. They don't call them, you know, kings and queens anymore, but Franklin Roosevelt referred to them as economic royalists. So there's this huge gap between the few super rich and everyone else. And you write that before the war, there was a blithe lack of concern among the wealthy about the rising tide of unhappiness at the gap in resources and power between rich and poor, unquote. And then, obviously, came the war and upheavals, which, you write, shook the very foundations of the monarchies of continental Europe. We saw the Occupy movement 2-3 years ago, which certainly left its mark. I mean, everybody now knows the 99%, the 1%. Do you see any indications at all that the foundations of our economic royalty are being shaken now? Is the economic royalty at all nervous? I don't sense that they are. What's your sense, Dr. Adams?
I don't know that the very wealthy are in the least bit nervous. But that is a characteristic of the Edwardian era as well. Before the First World War, the wealthy, the aristocratic Brits, and even the rising bourgeoisie, the manufacturing bourgeoisie, right, of places like Manchester and Leeds and the big cities of the UK, were themselves super confident that not only did they rule by right, but they were wealthy by right, and taking care of oneself and ruling through by taking care of oneself and a blithe disregard for the problems of the poor and the disadvantaged and the low income, mm-hmm, were all characteristics of the Edwardian era. I've just finished reading a wonderful book, actually, by J.B. Priestley called The Edwardians, who captures this social and socioeconomic dimension perfectly. That those who had felt they deserved what they had, and that those who did not have were people who were not deserving and not worthy of consideration. That is, you could see the change emerging, that blithe ignorance about what was coming, was undermined over time by in this same era, the Edwardian era. It was the organization of trades unions in the late 19th, early 20th century, the rise of the Labour Party in the UK, the rise of socialist parties in the European continent, the progressive movement in the United States. They all have echoes of each other because they were an awareness in the society that something had to change. Even the whole suffrage movement comes about and has its impact in this area, the rise of women, the awareness that women had a role outside, the very bottom jobs at the bottom of upstairs, downstairs, and the wealthy dilettantism of women in the Edwardian households, the rich in the Edwardian households. There was a supreme unawareness of the change that was coming. In fact, scorn about the awareness of the change that was coming. That the trade union movements and socialist parties and the labor parties were trivial and wasteful and nonsense and unnecessary and all would be well as long as the structure of class relations remained what they are. What you do see, I think, now, today, is on a very global scale, a reflection of that, a yawning gap. Not, you know, Hedrick Smith has written a book about this subject, published a year or two ago, that, you know, the income of the middle class is disappearing in the United States, and the income gap between the United States, inside the United States, is one of the worst that it's ever been since the Depression. One of the worst. A study of comparing countries that I mentioned in the article that you're talking about from last September says, you know, using this particular methodology where you look at the share of income and wealth held by the top 10% as compared to the bottom 40% and compared countries to each other, the United States comes out with a distribution of wealth that is 44th out of 86 countries, right? Mm-hmm. That is surpassed, that is more, it, less equal than countries like India or Nigeria or even Kazakhstan, countries that we see as very poor, and indeed, in an absolute sense, they are, but where wealth and income are more evenly distributed than they are in the United States. Well, that kind of unequal distribution sets up social tensions. It sets up political tensions. It creates instabilities. Those who benefit from that inequality are blithely ignorant of it. You know, sure. Live in private jets and very expensive houses and gated towns, and one of them is in the United States and one in Singapore and one in Geneva. What do you care? What do you know? And we see that, of course, popularized in American culture today. But that yawning gap, both within countries and between countries and regions, is a source of tension and instability. And again, we don't know where it's going to go. We don't know how it's going to develop, but we know that it's there, and we see signs of it. The poverty of the current generation in the Middle East, the young generation, right, in Egypt, in Syria, in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, that failure of those economies to narrow the gap, to provide employment opportunities, to develop and invest and grow, both public and private, is feeding an instability that is also fed by the Sunni-Shiite tensions, the intrusions of foreign powers, and the like. So, you know, what was happening in Tahrir Square, mm-hmm, was in part an expression of this underlying inequality and the inability of people to find, younger people, to find employment opportunities and educational opportunities and to actually grow. So we're in an era of, I think, shifting sands here, where we don't know quite where the wind is going to blow this, but the inequality is going to be, I think, a very important dimension, both nationally here in the United States and internationally.
Wow. I'm hearing a lot of rhyming, as you say. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show today with Professor Gordon Adams, who was professor of international relations at American University's School of International Service. We're talking about echoes of 1914 in 2014. You talk about the, you know, some of these struggles that have gone on, the so-called Arab Spring. It seems that, you know, this at the root of many of these struggles is economic inequality. I mean, you know, the Saudis have been in power for very long. They have tremendous wealth. And somehow they seem to have kept the lid on for a really long time. And I want to talk first about places other than the United States, where my sense is, you know, the people, the former bourgeoisie, the former middle class, at least have some sense that, hey, you know what? They can do something about this. They can make some change. They took to the streets, and they have made change, you know, in many different places. I wonder, I mean, my guess is the Saudis don't have any, well, maybe they do worry about it a little bit. I don't know. But you know, again, let's talk first about other countries and then, you know, look at here, if, you know, how much of a rhyme there may be between 2014 and 1914 on this front.
I think you're right to raise the Middle East as a core dilemma here, because what you have is a kind of a jostling that expands, if you will, the vibration. When you have political repression, you have economic lack of growth and lack of employment, you have religious conflict, and you have foreign intrusion. And if you put all of those things together in that region, which, and they do exist, that is the kind of instability that I'm saying is very hard for us to predict and very hard to forecast the outcome.
Sounds like the
so
Balkans,
many factors
too.
Are now creating vibrations against each other.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the Balkans, as you described, which were the flashpoint, it seems like virtually all those factors were there as well.
You had religious conflict, you had political repression, you had foreign power intrusion, you had collapsing empires. Again, not everything is the same.
Right.
But the rhyming is very interesting here. And you mentioned the Saudis. Mm-hmm. The Saudi monarchy knows, I think, very consciously how precarious their perch is. And they have always, when they've had the money, tried to do something to buy social stability. They have bought religious stability by letting the Wahhabi religious faction in Saudi Arabia basically control religious behavior and morals and, you know, social practice. They buy economic stability by providing a fairly extensive welfare state to the population that is in Saudi Arabia. And they do it because they're, I think, painfully aware that if they don't do it,
right,
they sit on a very precarious throne. So for the Saudis seem to have been more aware of this than others in terms of trying to deal with it, and have had the resources to both, you know, allow the wealthy to have their villas in Spain and in Switzerland and do their traveling and go to Western universities and colleges and get wonderful educations and the like, and to invest in technology and all those things, but at the same time buy over time some social stability. When the oil prices are too low, the Saudis really worry about instability in Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
So they've exported some tension by allowing people to go overseas and become activists in organizations that are more terrorist-oriented elsewhere. So they were very supportive of the effort to throw the Soviets out of Afghanistan, for example. Mm-hmm. But they are tough, repressive, and in an odd kind of way, generous to their population to buy the stability that keeps them in power.
Wow. Wow, and all it might take is some Principe fellow, some assassination of, you know, that was that sparked it all in Serbia, and that was, you know, Serbia was the place that all these big powers wanted to have control over. It was, you know, that whole Balkans area, and they must be, quite frankly, quite frightened that there could be some assassination. I can imagine they must think that, well, if the large majority of the population that's being thrown the crumbs, and they're, I guess, pretty nice crumbs, you know, if they see a chance, they might take it. And boy, that could get ugly fast.
It could change things very quickly. It'd be interesting to see what would happen right now, for example, if Assad were assassinated.
Right.
Things happen like that in Baghdad, so one can't rule it out. But I think you see the tremendous fear of change and the inability to deal with it in the way Assad has responded to the civil war in his own country. History has a lot of wars that have been very, very repressive. This is one of the ugliest that I know. When you've got, you know, 25-30% of the Syrian population basically uprooted, either outside the country or uprooted inside the country, that's huge. When you have mass graves that are being uncovered, that's huge. When you have chemical weapons attacks, that's huge. This is an ugly, vicious, brutal conflict, and Assad has clearly decided, you know, no compromise here.
Right.
Unrelenting terrorism on his own population to ensure the survival of the regime.
And I wonder how, I mean, that's obviously horrible, and it seems like the more we learn, the more just unbelievably inhuman the Assad regime is being. Yet, I mean, just in terms of, you know, for this discussion, the global implications, you know, as horrible as it is, you know, to be honest, I imagine most of the big powers would rather that it stay within Syria. But, you know, say, as you said, that as Assad is assassinated, something happens there, I wonder how much of a you know, will things just smooth out rather quickly afterwards? I mean, we see fighting within the you know, the rebel side, the revolutionary side there. They're killing each other as well. I wonder, you know, how much like Sarajevo, Syria could be.
This is the unpredictable element that I'm talking about. Because if you look at the Syrian civil war, it's not constrained within Syria.
Hmm.
It is destabilizing in the Kurdish region in northern Syria, which overlaps with the PKK region in Turkey. Right, so there's an instability there. It's destabilizing on the southern border of Turkey because of millions of Syrians living in brutal conditions because they've been uprooted. You have Hezbollah, a Lebanon power, intruding in military force with Assad inside Syria, which is destabilizing in Lebanon. You have the growing power of Hezbollah destabilizing and nerve-making in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. You have the Iraqi border being crisscrossed now by al-Qaeda-type activists coming from first Iraq into Syria, now Syria into Iraq, destabilizing places like Fallujah and Ramadi in Iraq. And the government in Baghdad is now at war, if you will, internally, having to increase its own security apparatus. You have the Saudis supporting the certain factions in the Syrian civil war. You have the Iranians sending the Quds force, their own Republican Guard, in to do military training and actual fighting in Syria. You already have a regional war going on in the guise of a civil war in Syria. Any one of those could become more explosive. Here's the interesting piece of all of that, and that is, we can talk fear, we can talk scare, we can talk upheaval, we can talk unpredictability. The hard piece for Americans, I think, to accept, and particularly for people like in Washington, where I live and work, to accept, is we can't control it.
Right.
We have an assumption that was built in by 70 years of Cold War and just post-Cold War experience that says, when we say frog, people jump. When we try to bring peace, peace arrives. When we try to make war, war happens and it succeeds. When we want NATO to do something, NATO does something. When, you know, we want something to happen in a region and we say this is what should happen in a region, we can actually make it happen. The key to this whole rebalancing of the international system is the recognition that the United States no longer has the capacity to do that. And it's not like we lost something. It's like the world changed. And so now we cannot do that. I watch Secretary Kerry in Europe trying to bring peace in the Syrian war. I watch him trying to bring peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. God bless him for trying in a way, but I think what he's butted up against here is the reality that frog and jump don't go together anymore with respect to the United States, and that's very disconcerting. It's very disconcerting to a country that has been extraordinarily powerful, has had a huge impact on the world stage, has been described as a hyperpower, to recognize the limits on what we can do and to recognize the importance of being able to be in the other guy's shoes so we know what's really going on with them. And to accept the fact that we can't just rush in and fix it.
Right.
I think that's the challenge for American foreign policy today.
Hmm.
And it's made worse by the politics here at home. Right? You have the Kelly Ayotte's and John McCain's and Lindsey Graham's of the world jumping up and down on what they hope will soon be the political corpse of Barack Obama, saying, you got to fix this. You're not doing enough. You got to get in there. Aren't you tough enough? The America's the tough power. We should be making things happen here. Okay, were we to adopt what I would call the Bush W strategy it would only make things worse because you don't have the capacity to make things happen. But we have this instinct to send the 82nd Airborne and fix it. That would only be further destabilizing because we don't control the conditions under which all this upheaval is taking place. So I think that the transition in the system is really hard for a United States that's been used to being the dominant world power since 1945.
Wow, it really is. And you can see that the Ayotts and the McCains and all those guys saying, we got to do something. We got to send in the cavalry and just, you know, fix it. And, you know, when Obama was threatening to bomb Syria after the use of chemical weapons was revealed, people on the right and left said, no, this isn't going to help. And I just find, Professor, I have so many, again, not exactly parallels, but rhymes. So well put, Mark Twain. Boy, I wonder what he'd say now. I guess he said it all anyway. But, you know, in certainly, as you mentioned, in the last half century, the United States has unquestionably been the most powerful military force. Prior to 1914, my impression is that Britain, again, formerly Great Britain, was in a similar situation. They had this massive empire, huge navy, and you write, quote, something is clearly going on underneath the reality of that military power that is weakening the hold the United States had over the international system. And, you know, I wonder about, I'm old enough to remember Vietnam. How is it that we fail to recognize that after our horrible military adventure in Vietnam, that the limits of reliance on military power were quite real? We had overwhelming military power compared to the, you know, Vietnamese. And yet, we couldn't beat them. We couldn't win. The people there knew what they were fighting for. And, you know, how is it that we fail to learn that lesson? And here you got the Republicans, as you say, jumping up and down saying, you know, more military adventures. Do we learn? I mean, have we learned at all from that experience in Vietnam, do you think?
I think we developed a collective amnesia about Vietnam that led almost directly to the Bush invasion of Iraq. And the parallels here to the UK, again, the rhyme, if you will, to the UK is kind of interesting. You're quite right to say before the First World War, the dominant power on the world stage Absolutely. Was the dominant naval power with the largest empire. That would be the Brits,
yep.
Who stayed out of some of these little quarrels in on the continent.
True.
Interestingly, for the Brits, the beginning of the dissolution of their empire was the Boer War.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, not like Vietnam, but in some sense, also not dissimilar. Now, it was a European settler population that said for generations existence in South Africa that was taking on the great British Empire. But the Brits stumbled in the Boer War. And while it was not huge, it was huge in the British political consciousness that they recognized that the Boer War was a mistake. Late 1890s, yes. Early 1900s, preceded by about 10 years, the First World War. And it was saying, you know, there's a restiveness out there in the colonies. There's a restiveness in this empire. Why, we'll just walk in there and fix it?
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? They couldn't just walk in there and fix it.
Right.
It was a little bit of a wake-up call, but not enough of one that it prevented the Brits from sliding, you know, with flag-waving, cheering crowds on the streets of London into the commitment to World War One. This was going to be the war to end all wars. Yeah. By God, they were going to finish it off.
Yeah.
And the comeuppance that they got was over a million dead.
Yes.
On the battlefields of Belgium and France. The loss of a whole class of people, young men, who, you know, saw no further existence, invented no new things, wrote no new plays, stopped writing their poetry, sang no songs, worked in no factories, disappeared from Britain. You know, the consequence of that in terms of social upheaval for women was actually a positive thing, but that was the consequence of this war. And Britain overall turned from a creditor nation to a debtor nation through World War One. And who were they indebted to? To the United States. The United States became the banker of Britain through the process of the slide from a dominant empire to a declining empire. And the Brits didn't get that message for another roughly 30 years, fully, right? The real dissolution of the British Empire happened after the Second World War. So they were hanging on, you know, much as we hung on in the invasion of Iraq, you know, rhyming here. hung on to that power position, to the sense of being powerful, to the sense of being dominant. It really took World War II, which technically they won, obviously the huge support of both Russia and the United States, to emerge from World War II impoverished as a nation, incapable of holding on to the empire. And over the period from 1945 to 1955, you saw the British Empire, you know, the sun definitely set on it. It disappeared around the world. So I think it takes great nations and powerful nations a long time to learn that the power shift has happened, that the change is underway, that the rebalancing is going on. And I think the underlying point that you mentioned, Bert, which is very important here, is it seems to be the instinct of empires when that process is going on to hang on, but to hang on by use of military force.
Mm.
The one instrument, the one area where you can say the United States is still today, as the United States, a dominant power. It's not diplomacy, it's not politics, it's not even economics.
No.
It is military capability. We still have the only global military force in the world, just as the Brits did before the First World War. It's our big, if you will, trump card in international events. And increasingly, and I've been writing about this separate writings, increasingly we turn to the military capability to fix problems that really don't have military solutions.
Yes.
So, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan were the big pieces where we turned to the military and said, regovern that country, reconstruct that country, do the public diplomacy, fix this, will you? Right?
Right.
And we failed,
right.
Frankly.
No, absolutely.
The military is the wrong tool for that. It's not clear there's any tool that's appropriate for doing that when a great power tries to adjust another country. You know, history of empires says doesn't work very well when you try to do that. We are still relying on the military to provide training for security throughout a lot of countries in Africa, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in other countries in Asia. We're still asking the U.S. military forces to be the peacekeeping force, the governance trainer, the developer. I was hearing the other day about a meeting that the Special Forces, Special Operations Command is holding to try to figure out how to counter Chinese economic and public diplomacy penetration of Latin America. And I said to myself, you know, what a futile mission that is. The military has no capability for even thinking about how to do private sector investment.
Amazing.
About how to handle public diplomacy in a region that's not riddled with conflict and war. It's just not a military mission. But here we go again. We're still stuck on this weird sense that we have that the only competent capability to do anything abroad in the American government happens to be the United States military, when the history of the last 12 years tells us it ain't so.
Reality doesn't seem to, you know, have to interject here. And, you know, you talked about China and Latin America. Well, look at Africa right now. China is tremendous in Africa. Huge markets developing there. And where are we? There's no military solution to that. And if you look at what this absolute reliance on military, and again, I'm reminded of the British feeling like, oh, well, they have the cavalry. That'll fix the Germans. Didn't work real well against machine guns in the trenches. We just seem to be relying on military solutions, and it's breaking the United States budget. We spend huge, trillions of dollars, and as I believe it was Churchill, you would know, Professor Adams, who said that Afghanistan is the graveyard of empires, and it's proving to be. And yet we're spending all this money, and most of the people of the United States, Democrats included, don't seem to get how incredibly wasteful that is, and it may be causing, you know, social, I don't know about upheaval, because Americans feel so incredibly powerless, they don't think they can do anything about it, but, you know, it's weakening America. All this reliance on military seems to be weakening the United States, which is, we're all this strong, but we're getting weaker. And going back to the beginning of the First World War, it was Woodrow Wilson who got elected with the phrase, he kept us out of war. Now, certainly, again, there's no real parallels, but the popular sentiment against the war elected both Woodrow Wilson and Barack Obama. In 2008, he was seen as less dangerous in terms of expanding the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. But he has expanded military actions in places like Somalia with the use of drones, terrible destabilization in our ally, with our ally Pakistan. I mean, what we're doing there with the drones is, seems to me just shockingly dumb, quite frankly. But I wonder what kind of rhyme you see there between Obama and Woodrow Wilson, who, of course, is the guy that got us into the war.
It's a very interesting rhyme, if you will. Wilson's not Obama. Obama is Wilson. But there's a touchstone which both of them are related to that has a long history in American statecraft. And that is the idea of American exceptionalism.
Oh, yes.
That we are a uniquely positioned nation in the world, a notion that goes all the way back to the founding fathers and the Revolution and the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, that as the flagship of democracy, we have established ourselves as a country that breaks with history. It is outside history. And at the moment the United States was created, that was an understandable argument because the break was with the European monarchies,
right,
the Brits.
We were west of history. Yes.
We did not want them intruding into our world, and we did not want to intrude into their world. And what George Washington said was, we will not form any permanent alliances with anybody, and we're different. And that tradition of the U.S. being different pervades American statecraft right up to the present day. It's very hard for somebody like Barack Obama, who has tried to say some of these things, to say, it's a different world, we can't govern the way we used to play a role in the world, but even out of his mouth you will hear we are an exceptional nation,
right.
That we are a flagship city on the hill, that we are an example to everybody, that we have a manifest destiny, which was the popular term at the turn of the last century in the United States, to bring order to the world, to bring order out of chaos. Woodrow Wilson, in my judgment, was a real turning point in American statecraft. Because having said all those things about staying out of war that sounded like the sort of Washingtonian tradition of staying out of permanent alliances and the like, not only did he wade into the First World War 1917 to fix it,
right,
he personally went to Paris to negotiate the Versailles Treaty to bring about the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the expansion of democracy. He took a personal diplomatic role as president. In arriving at that treaty, he couldn't make it stick with the Senate. It didn't get ratified, and the United States was out of the formal structural international institution of nations right up to the Second World War. But what was consistent with him, and I think it's part of this hard adjustment for the United States to make today, is that, you know, in most respects, we are a nation like other nations. We're not an exceptional nation. We're not that different from other nations, bigger, better armed, bigger teeth, if you will. But we have interests. We pursue those interests, sometimes a little bit ugly about the way we pursue them. But we're not that special. And if you accept that we can't run the world anymore, and we're not the sole power in the world anymore, and we're not actually that special, now you're looking at the kind of change in the American self-perception that is very similar to what the Brits had to go through from pre-World War I to the late 1940s, well, actually up to the Suez Crisis. Because the last time the Brits tried to say, wait a minute, we are going to order things in another part of the world, in this case the Suez Canal, was in 1956 when Gamal Abdel Nasser closed the canal, and the Brits and the French and the Israelis attacked in Egypt to open it up again, right? And got a comeuppance from Dwight Eisenhower, of all people, who said, no, you don't, and I'm going to cut you guys off if you keep this up. And they had no choice. They had to stop. And that was that Suez invasion in 56, I think, was the final wake-up call for the Brits, that they no longer ran the world and could not expect to. Right? We have not had that wake-up call happen to us yet. But they're all the pieces that say wake up are lying around us. We've been talking about it for the last 50 minutes.
And it's, I mean, you won't find any politician who would go near a statement like that, you know, backing off from the, you know, enshrined notion of American exceptionalism. They just won't touch it at all. And
it's not safe politically.
No, of course not.
It's not safe politically.
And yet, so
you're saying we're weak. Oh, my God, there's nothing worse to an American than to say he's weak.
Right. Well, we're terribly strong militarily, no doubt about that, but it doesn't do any good. I mean, you look at the terrorists. It costs nothing to build these little bombs or, you know, go on a suicide mission, whatever. We are, in fact, we can't seem to stop those things. And again, you know, Woodrow Wilson, you know, high-mindedly said the First World War was about making the world safe for democracy, which, of course, the 1919 treaty pretty much guaranteed Hitler would arise, so it didn't make the world safe for democracy. Professor Adams, I'd like to end on a positive note. Do you have any degree of optimism that once the people are waking up, that, you know, we're starting to see that, you know, that the reliance on military power just isn't working, and that the, you know, the paradigm that we've had for so long in Saudi Arabia and so many places, we have a super rich few controlling and keeping the lid on, it's not going to work. Do you have any sense that that things could get better, that good things may come out of some kind of realization, or are we going to have some, you know, bad stuff happen first before we get it?
We may have to have a crisis, though I have to say one of the things that was interesting to me was that through the period from, you know, 2010 until today, until the most recent budget agreement, if you asked them, the polling data said, if you asked the American people what's important to them,
right,
it was not the war in Afghanistan. It was not the war in Iraq. It
right.
was not terrorism. It was not even international issues in general.
Right.
There was a kind of a come-home America moment that started with the 2008 recession and got accelerated in the arguments over the budget that led to the first decline that we'd seen in the defense budget in the United States since 1998. And it's continued to steadily go down every year since 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14 is down, 15 is down, and I'm talking about constant dollars after inflation. The defense budget has been coming down, and the public attention has been elsewhere. It's been on immigration and some social issues,
jobs,
and health care, and above all, jobs and the economy.
Right.
And there is a very strong sense that I see in every piece of polling data that I look at, that the American people are very tired of these international adventures that largely George Bush got us into.
Yeah, true.
And want to bring the troops home and want to end these wars that don't seem to solve our domestic problems, and are prepared to focus on the domestic issues that we do need to focus on. And it doesn't seem to be, it's not an isolationist sentiment. I think that one of the worst words that we throw around all the time is isolationism.
Right.
There are very, very few Americans who could be called isolationist, meaning I don't want to be anywhere else in the world, and I don't want to hear about it, and I don't want to see it, and I don't want us involved in it.
Right.
Even the libertarians have figured out that we're involved in the international world.
Right.
It's the way we're involved that people are concerned about. And it's the assumption that, you know, we and only we are capable of being involved in fixing things. So there's some sign, if you will, that the kind of dominant world assumption is weakening, that domestic issues are moving to the fore, an awareness that the global economy is not something we run. You know, these changes are very gradual. Where they haven't translated themselves yet successfully is politics. I mean, we've said here a couple of times, you know, if you step out and say the world's rebalancing and the United States can't say frog and have everybody else jump anymore and we're not the exceptional nation, we're just another nation like other nations,
right,
you pay a price politically outside of some very safe districts in places that we know, like Madison, Wisconsin, and Boston, Massachusetts, and Austin, Texas, and the Bay Area, and California, and New York City. But when you're outside those areas, you pay a political price in this country because the official rhetoric is different from the reality that we're dealing with.
Yeah, now if only we could deal with reality. Well, you've shed a tremendous amount of light on our current reality. Professor Gordon Adams, you write for Foreign Policy Magazine. I don't know if there are other places people can look at your works.
Foreign Policy is where I do the most accessible work that people can find.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Been very, very enlightening, and it's nice to hear this, a little bit of hope that people are getting it. Thank you so much, Professor Gordon Adams. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you.
Jim and John, I'm a crazy man, no place to go. There ain't nobody hiring here since I'm jumping down to Mexico. Reckon I learned self-trade, made me see the world. Moved to the city someday, married a black-haired girl. Somebody somewhere had another plan. Now he's got a rifle in his hand, rolling in a bag and wondering how he got this far. Just another poor boy out to fight a rich man's war. Bobby had an eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue to the bone with a land in Kandahar. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. A stack of overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now, he's still there. Chasing ghosts and thin dry air. Meanwhile, back at home, the finest company took his car. Just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war.